Last year, more than 150,000 people in Illinois were able to buy health insurance with help from a federal subsidy. On Thursday, the Trump administration said it's stopping those payments.
You know, it's one thing to sort of pull the pin on the grenade and wave it over your head. It's another to lob the grenade into the insurance marketplace, and that's what the president's done here.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley talking about the Affordable Care Act on Morning Edition last week. Today, how it may affect Illinois. Plus, the Lincoln Presidential Library has collected high school sports stories from people across the state.
The value of participating in sports, it gives them self-confidence. It teaches them responsibilities, not just to themselves, but to other people.
That's a girls' basketball coach at Marshall High School in Chicago. Also, why Illinois' largest migrant farm worker camp appears to shut down, and the latest in Illinois politics. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Good morning and welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Subsidies for low-income people are a key part of the Affordable Care Act. Here in Illinois, more than 150,000 people have been able to afford health insurance with that help. But last Thursday, the Trump administration announced that it would end these subsidies, which help cover the cost of premiums for people who are buying insurance through the healthcare exchanges. 19 states have already sued the federal government in response. Joining me now to make sense of how this will affect Illinois is Matthew Weinstock. He's the managing editor of Modern Healthcare. Hi, Matt. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Matt, there's so many elements of the Affordable Care Act, whether we're talking about expanding Medicaid or the whole debate about pre-existing conditions. Those tend to grab the headlines. What specifically are these subsidies that the Trump administration says it's going to stop paying?
Right. As you said, there are so many elements to the ACA. The issue at hand, these subsidies affect, as you said, about 175,000 people here in Illinois. But what they are is they are baked into the Affordable Care Act, and they're a way for insurance, for the federal government to help insurance companies offset the cost of offering low-income people more affordable health insurance. So the premiums that we're specifically talking about here targeted folks who are at about 100 to 250% of poverty. So that would be for an individual roughly $12,000 to $30,000 a year in income, for a family of four, anywhere from $24,000 to $60,000 a year. And again, the insurance companies, the Affordable Care Act mandates that insurance companies offer people in that range of income subsidies to help pay for their insurance. What's at issue here is whether or not the federal government will continue to provide money back to the insurance companies to offset the loss that they would face by doing that.
So some people might be confused, Matt, about whether or not the Trump administration has the power to decide this. Lots of people know that kind of, you know, civics 101 is that Congress is the part of the government that has the power of the purse, so to speak. Where are we at with thinking about, I wonder what your thoughts are about the Trump administration, this executive action in terms of how it would actually affect subsidies?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great legal question. The estimate was that in 2017, there would be $7 billion paid back to insurers to help them offset these the cost of these subsidies. Interestingly, the House Republicans, when President Obama was in office, actually sued the Obama administration, claiming that these subsidies were not legal because, as you point out, Congress has the power of the purse string. The federal court sided with the House Republicans, and then that went into appeal. The Trump administration hadn't yet weighed in on that particular lawsuit, but kept making these payments on a monthly basis to insurers. Where we stand now is there are the suits from 19 attorney generals, state's attorneys generals, including Lisa Madigan here in Illinois. Several insurance companies have indicated they might sue because the law does say that insurance companies have to make these payments. What's at question is whether or not the law stipulates that Congress has to appropriate funds for that. And, you know, legal minds greater than mine are the ones that are going to figure that out.
Do you have a sense of how not paying these subsidies would affect Illinois patients and insurers?
Sure. So Illinois was one state out of several that the insurance commissioner actually asked health plans to, when they were formulating their rates for 2018, told them to factor in that these cost-sharing reduction payments would not be made. So in Illinois, bronze plans would go up 20%, silver plans would go up 35%, and gold plans 16%.
And those costs, and then those costs, are those costs passed directly on to the patients then? So then this is something people are paying for?
Right, that would be an increase of your premium. So silver plans, 61% of Illinois people who buy insurance off the exchange are in the silver plan, so it's the most popular. So what the Illinois State Commissioner did was said, we don't think that the cost-sharing reduction payments are going to come in. So when you calculate premiums for your silver plans, factor that into it. And so insurance companies rose premium rates 35% from year to year, from 2017 to 2018, because they assumed they weren't going to get this payment back from the government.
That said, it sounds like it's already been factored in. Go ahead.
No, well, so it's been factored in for those folks, but the ripple effect may be people who aren't at that level of poverty, right? So who aren't 100 to 250% of poverty, who are above that, the costs would come back to people buying insurance on the market who don't get a subsidy, because the insurance companies are going to have to make up that loss somewhere.
Oh, okay. So it actually may affect what you're saying, as opposed to lower income people, they will try to make it up by raising premiums for people who are more middle income.
That's a process that could happen. Yeah. The other thing that could happen is by statute and by contract, insurers actually, if these payments are not made to them, because again, they're mandated, if the payments aren't made, that gives them an out to actually pull out of the marketplace. So you could see insurers withdraw. So far, as of last week, Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is the state's largest insurer, Cigna, and Health Alliance, those are some of the biggest providers on the exchanges, they've said they're not going to pull out. But, you know, things could change. People in Chicago well remember Land of Lincoln last year, which went bankrupt, and about middle of the year, a lot of people had to scramble to find more coverage or different means of coverage.
So it remains to be seen, of course, with all of these things. More uncertainty, obviously, which is something we know we've been hearing not just from insurers but hospitals they don't want to deal with. But thanks for helping us understand this a little bit more. Matt Weinstock is the managing editor of Modern Healthcare, based in Chicago. Matt, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Each year, migrant farm workers journey hundreds of miles to detassel corn and pick vegetables here in Illinois, often for little pay. And while many of those workers arrange housing on their own, some end up staying in employer-provided facilities. Sometimes they're camps that are inspected by the State Department of Public Health. For years, the biggest of these facilities was Camp Nightingale in Rantoul, a converted hospital located on the decommissioned Chanute Air Force Base. We've talked about Camp Nightingale before on the 21st and highlighted some of the many problems there: mold, pet infestations, down phone lines, just to name a few of them. This season, there aren't any workers staying at the camp, and it's no longer licensed with the state. Pam Dempsey is executive director of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. She's in our Urbana studios to tell us what happened to Camp Nightingale. I want to also welcome Miguel Keberlin Gutierrez. He's on who's on the line, director of the Immigrant and Worker Rights Practice Group at the Legal Assistance Foundation in Chicago. Pam, Miguel, both of you, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Pam, let's start out just with what you all found with Camp Nightingale's current status. Why was it no longer licensed? What happened?
We really don't know. One of our newest reporters, Anna Casey, was out talking to people and just found out that the camp, where migrant workers have stayed since 2001 there in Rantoul, was no longer being used for that. The owners had applied for a license at a different location. So we've put calls into the health department. All we know is that they did not apply for another license. to operate out of the old Air Force hospital base.
And can you remind us, Pam, what the conditions were like in this previous camp?
Sure. You know, for years, health inspectors have cited the camp for having things like missing light bulbs or broken smoke detectors, flickering lights where sometimes the plumbing didn't work very well as well. So the conditions were a little bit erratic. They weren't things that had been cited in one year would continue to be cited in the next.
And so where are the workers staying now?
They're staying at the Quarters Inn and Suites. It's a hotel about a 10-minute walk away from the Air Force Base, about almost half a mile away. It actually used to be used to house the U of I, University of Illinois football players during when they would train in the summer.
Oh, okay. So Camp Nightingale was the largest migrant labor camp in Illinois. How many workers are we talking about who are now staying at these Quarters Inn and Suites?
So according to the license, they're allowed up to about 450 workers in the hotel, the same as they were at the hospital.
And do we know what conditions are like in the hotel?
Well, according to some of our reporting, we did actually go out and talk to people living there. They find it much nicer. They don't have the very same issues that that they were experiencing at the hospital. One worker said she actually has been coming for 11 years, so she's been both in the hospital and at the hotel. And she said, you know, the lights don't flicker, and when I'm cooking, my the electrical breaker doesn't give out. So she also finds that the private bathrooms are really nice. They're a bit of an upgrade from what I understand.
We actually have a clip of a worker describing his room at Camp Nightingale back when he stayed there in 2014. The worker is Eli Maldonado from Mission, Texas, talking to one of our 21st producers, Bob Holly, who used to work for you, Pam, at the Midwest Center. Let's take a listen to Eli.
This is my room. It's one of the biggest rooms in here. We have two refrigerators. There was 8 beds for 8 people in here. Mostly young people, like 25 and younger, 26 and younger. Right now, only me and my friend stayed. Over there, we have a little, you know, where you could wash your hands, brush your teeth, a little station. We have a little microwave. We also have skillets to cook, warm up tortillas, you know. I think it's good. I mean, I don't have no problems living like this. I know there's worser places than this. It's just how we live, you know.
That's Eli Maldonado. That's actually an interview from 2014 talking about Camp Nightingale, which was the largest migrant worker labor camp in the state of Illinois that's now no longer in use. Pam Dempsey's with me. She's executive director of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. That's where that audio came from. Miguel Keberline Gutierrez is with us as well. He's the director of the Immigrant and Worker Rights Practice Group at the Legal Assistance Foundation. Miguel, you and others from your organization are traveling around the state often, checking in with workers. How common is it to hear, like, as we heard Eli's story, is that a pretty common, those both expectations that the workers have as well as conditions of where they are?
Yeah, I would say, you know, workers aren't primarily coming here for the free housing that might come with the work. I think it's really a comprehensive deal. So I think workers sort of withstand the conditions of poor housing if they're getting decent employment. But I would say, you know, most of the housing that migrants are living in Illinois is, I think most people would find it substandard for their own families.
And what percentage of workers rely on their employers for housing in the migrant worker population?
I would say true migrant farm workers, which includes foreign guest workers coming in under the H-2A program, I would say you're talking about 90% of the workers who come in.
Okay. So that's I mean, 90% of this population is relying on their employer, whether it's in a hotel or in a camp like what was in Rantoul. Miguel, can I ask you, the Illinois Department of Public Health keeps a list of all active migrant labor camps and inspects them throughout the year. Does the same thing happen when they're in a hotel?
So it doesn't. I think the Department of Health doesn't inspect hotels the same way they would a standalone facility. I think they look at hotels as there's sort of this, they call the innkeeper exception to the law, and they sort of inspect hotels the way, you know, any other inspection might happen of a hotel outside of migrant laborers living there. But if you do look at the Illinois Migrant Labor Camp law, it basically doesn't say that in there. It says, you know, a migrant labor camp is basically anywhere there's more than 10 workers or 4 families living together for the purposes of working for an employer.
So, Miguel, I want to ask you this, and Pam, we're not going to have time, I think, for you to finish this, if you could answer this after the break. But, Miguel, if they're not inspected as part of the same process, does that mean that these impromptu hotel camps have sort of other challenges or problems that are not being caught?
Yeah, that's certainly our understanding. I mean, I would say if you just look at the list of migrant labor camps, there's only, I think, less than 25 this past year that were licensed. We keep our own list of migrant labor camps, and there's well over 100 labor camps operating in the state of Illinois. But if the department isn't aware of somebody applying for a license and someone's still operating a camp, they're not going to go out and inspect it unless someone brings that to their attention.
And that's what you guys do?
We try to. I mean, the Department of Labor certainly has, or the Department of Health, they have limits on what they can do, and they're certainly, their hands are tied a little bit with the budget issues of Illinois, but we certainly try to do that.
We're going to pick up this conversation just after this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We're going to continue to talk about the conditions in migrant worker labor camp housing with Miguel Keberlein Gutierrez from the Legal Assistance Foundation in Chicago, along with Pam Dempsey, who's executive director of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Stay tuned. We'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes on the other side of this short break.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Coveting Nature, Art, Collecting, and Natural History in Early Modern Europe, an exhibition of botanical artwork from U of I collections. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boudou. Thanks for tuning in. We are talking about migrant worker labor camps, more than 100 as we're learning, throughout Illinois that are operated. These are places that are housing workers who are journeying hundreds of miles to detassel corn, pick vegetables. We're talking about the conditions of their housing with Pam Dempsey. She's executive director for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Talking to us, we started this conversation about Camp Nightingale, which had been one of these largest of these labor camps in Rantoul. With us from Chicago is Miguel Keberlein Gutierrez, who's the director of Immigrant and Worker Rights Practice Group at the Legal Assistance Foundation in Chicago. Pam, as Miguel's telling us about more than 100 of these camps operating, we have sort of the official list of how many the Illinois Department of Public Health is overseeing, which is their responsibility. Where are these camps located throughout Illinois?
So according to the health department, they do keep a list. There are 18 camps registered. They're all over the state. There's one in Champaign, one in Urbana, one in Vermilion County in Georgetown, even Springfield and Burlington, Vienna. So they're scattered throughout wherever the work is, essentially.
And whose responsibility is it to list the camp? Is it the employer?
Yes, I believe both the employer as well as the person, I think it falls more to the person housing the workers there. It's up to them to get the camp registered.
Miguel, is that a different person oftentimes? Is it a different company that's contracted to do housing versus the employer? How does that work?
Well, you have a system that these large companies use, what they call farm labor recruiters, and that person is in charge of bringing the labor from maybe Southern Texas, Mexico, Florida, here. And it really depends. It's a negotiation between the employer and that person. If that person is paid to find the housing, then it's on them to get it registered. If it's the employer and it's their housing, they've been doing it a while, then they usually take care of getting it licensed themselves.
And what kind of basic housing rights do workers have when it's provided by the employer, Miguel?
So they, you know, they basically have your basic standard rights to a healthy place to live. There shouldn't be things like exposed wires. There shouldn't be, they should have sort of screens on the windows to keep out mosquitoes. There's a certain amount of footage that needs to be provided depending on how many people are in a room, beds for each person in the room. If it's a facility that has cooking as well, if it's in the same room, it has to be a larger room. Just some very basic standard things.
Pam, in your experience, did Camp Nightingale meet those requirements?
When we did our reporting, we looked at what the state found as violations. Just even a visiting, you could tell that maybe there were some issues. When we visited the camp in the past, things were pretty dark. There wasn't a lot of lighting. You saw things, similar things that maybe inspectors noted as well.
And Pam, do you have a sense now, as your reporters are talking to workers being in a hotel, that it's a better situation?
From what we understand and the people that we've spoken with, yes, they feel like it's, you know, they don't have the same issues as they did at the hospital base as they do in the hotel. A little bit of a better situation.
Miguel, a lot of your work with the Immigrant Workers Rights Practice Group deals with conditions in the field or when workers are having trouble getting paid. How often are there housing complaints as well?
Yeah, I would say almost, you know, almost every single time. I mean, if someone has an issue with their pay and things like that, then they'll also bring up, and the housing isn't so great. It's usually one of those things that sort of, they're willing to endure the poor housing conditions as long as they're getting work and being paid properly. But as soon as that's an issue, then they bring up the housing issues as well.
Okay, so that said, we just have a minute or two left. I wonder if, Miguel, if there's anything you wanted to add in terms of, particularly if there are migrant workers or community advocates who are listening right now, is there any information you think they need to know?
Yeah, I think just generally to understand that, you know, migrant housing, more often not than not, is just not good housing no matter where it is. I think the example of Nightingale Camp is that it was an old hospital, and there's whatever you want to do to decorate it up, it's still an old hospital. And most of the places that people are housed are sort of looked at from the lens of, well, they're only going to be here a couple of weeks, so we don't have to make it that great. And it's a very poor standard by which to operate.
Pam, for people who are listening to this who don't have any kind of affiliation with these workers or anything, I wonder what you want them to know about what you all have found with the Midwest Center about conditions in terms of housing.
Sure. I think maybe to reiterate what Miguel said, that it is easy to sort of, even from the worker perspective, to kind of overlook and sort of endure. But I think someone who's not in this field at all, it's kind of easy to forget, really, these workers aren't necessarily coming alone. They're children and families with them. So while it may seem like a lack of an air conditioner is not a problem for a few weeks, you got to think about people cooling off, lack of a proper washing and drying facilities. They have to wash off the pesticides. So there are associated health risks with some of these violations. And, you know, I think that's important, regardless of how temporary it is. I mean, some workers stay a few weeks and some stay a few months.
That's Pam Dempsey. She's the executive director of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. We will tweet out all of the work that they have done, particularly on Camp Nightingale. Pam, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
I want to thank Miguel Keberlin Gutierrez as well, on the line from Chicago, director of the Immigrant and Worker Rights Practice Group at the Legal Assistance Foundation. Thanks, Miguel.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Whether you're a star quarterback, a bench warmer, or the biggest mom and dad fan in the bleachers, you probably have some memory of high school sports. Well, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library is collecting those memories on tape as part of an oral history program. The new project is called Sports Stories, IHSA. It features 54 interviews with men and women from around the state talking about playing, coaching, and living high school sports. It includes women like Dorothy Gators, who began coaching after Congress passed Title IX legislation and led future WNBA stars to success, or longtime sports journalist Bob Sakamoto, who wrestled at Lane Tech High School in Chicago and went on to host the popular Preps Plus segment on CLTV. To learn more about this archive, we're joined by the director of the Oral History Program at the Abraham Lincoln Library, Mark DePew, who's actually on the line. Mark, I understand you're joining us from another presidential library. Is that correct?
Thank you very much. I'm actually out in Boston, and right now sitting in the John F. Kennedy Library and Museum.
Oh, well, that's appropriate. Thanks for joining us from another presidential library. We've also got one of the featured storytellers with us as well. Chicago native Louis Acevedo began as a football player at Thule High School, now Clemente. He then coached football and soccer at Clemente and went to Marie Curie High School on Chicago's Southwest Side to coach and serve as its PE department chair. Mark, welcome to the Louis, welcome to the 21st too.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate this.
Louis,
great,
let's
honor
start.
Being part of this program.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Let's start with you, because right at the beginning of your interview, which is featured at Illinois.gov, we're going to tweet out a link to that. You talk about Thule High on Chicago's West Side, the ethnic makeup of the neighborhood at the time. It was primarily European and Jewish, and you're Puerto Rican, but your coach didn't care.
No, my coach looked at people and said, if you see color, you got a problem. And I kind of grew up with that philosophy because my parents did the same thing. So I never saw color as being an issue or race being an issue or religion being an issue, because growing up, I worked for a lot of Jewish people, and they were really, really helpful in my development.
And how about the fact that you're 5'5 playing football? Was that something that was an issue?
Well, see, the problem was I didn't know I was 5'5". I thought I was 6'5". I had no idea that I was a midget.
Maybe that's not a problem, right, Louis?
No, it wasn't a problem for me. But look at Marie Tolan. He's one of the best players, and he's only 5'6".
So you ended up making a career in sports, right? Specifically high school sports.
Yeah,
why was that?
I guess because I was a gym rat, and I always felt that that was my niche, and it was something I could enjoy, and I could find success in, regardless of who I was.
Yeah,
and,
Mark,
I... In fact, both my kids are in sports.
What do they play?
Well, my son is the head wrestling coach at Plainfield, and Jason, and my younger son, Jacob, has actually gotten a coaching job down in Alabama coaching lacrosse, so...
Yeah, why do you think high school sports is so important?
Because it helps you build character, and it helps you recognize that you can make mistakes and still succeed. And it kind of you get knocked down and you get right back up and you keep right on going. And it's a challenge of taking that next step and moving forward and keep going and finding different levels of challenges.
That's Louis Acevedo, a former football coach at Clemente and Marie Curie High School in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Mark DePew is with us as well. Mark, as director of the Oral History Program at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, previously the library's collected oral histories of immigrant stories or veterans. Why high school sports? Why the Illinois High School Association?
Well, the short answer is I have a volunteer who works with us. He's a former superintendent. Phil Pogue is his name. And not only was he superintendent, he's also an official, officiates a lot of football games across the state. This was his passion. This was his idea. But it didn't take me long to figure out it'd be a great addition, because sports is so central to our young students' lives. And it was a great fit. He went out and collected 54 interviews in something like a year. That's an amazing pace. He went all over the state. He's doing this as a volunteer, not getting paid to do it. But he met people like Louis and 53 others, and it's been a wonderful addition to our collection. And I think, it is great history. It's an essence of a look at our society and our culture right now, and it's a perfect fit for what we do. And it throws people off sometimes. Abraham Lincoln, what's it got to do with Abraham Lincoln?
But did he play high school? Yeah. What sports did Abraham Lincoln play?
well,
he was
theoretically, stories about baseball, but Our institution used to be the Illinois State Historical Library, and we still have that mission. So my charter is all of Illinois history.
Okay. I wanted to, speaking of that, one of the things that we learned through this project, our producers and myself, all of us here at the 21st, was how unique Illinois High School Scholastic Association is in the types of activities it includes. 30 sports, which don't just include basketball and baseball, but also journalism and debate. And here's one that really surprised us. It's a recording captured by the Lincoln Library featuring high school principal and IHSA board member Jeanette Knuckles.
One activity was bass fishing that was added when I was at Normal. And we had students who were extremely excited about this. And our students did well. I think they won a regional championship. And we had, I think it might have been my second year, we had a student who was really interested in bass fishing, but for some disciplinary reasons, he was not allowed to go. But the student took it upon himself to drive and take his boat to Lake Carlisle, it's in Southern Illinois, and he wasn't even entered as a participant from Normal Community, but he wanted to fish and participate in the tournament. Launched his boat, got out there and was fishing, and ran into some trouble. So he had to be, helped back to shore. But his discipline only increased because of that.
That's Jeanette Knuckles, a high school principal and IHSA board member. That's part of the oral history project that the Abraham Lincoln Library, a presidential library, is collecting. So, Mark, bass fishing, also considered an Illinois high school sport. Where can we find, as you're collecting this oral history, where can the public access these stories?
Our collection we've got, the easiest way is to go to www.oralhistory.illinois.gov. That'll take you to our main landing page, and on the right-hand side you'll see all of the major collections we've got, and you want to click on sports stories, and then you'll see four selections there, and one of them is IHSA, Illinois High School Association. And these 54 interviews are part of that IHSA collection.
And Mark, what was the most surprising thing for you out of those interviews?
Well, I think you just mentioned it, bass fishing. But, you know, I was also surprised to find out that there's journalism competitions. You know, not so much about debate and things like that or speech. I certainly knew about that, but journalism threw me. Lacrosse was a surprise. But the other thing that I thought was very interesting was that IHSA is actually the co-owner of the term March Madness, that they came up with it first, and then the NCAA picked it up, and they actually had an extensive lawsuit, and eventually both institutions are able to use the term March Madness.
Wait, but is IHSA getting any revenue from this March Madness title? Because that's the big question, right?
I don't think so, no.
Oh, that's too bad. Louis, can I ask you, you were a coach, so we talked about sort of the whole idea of when you were playing sports, but for being a coach in your oral history, you can hear that that's something that was really important to you. What made coaching so special for you?
Well, I think what it is it gives you an opportunity to work with young people to find more avenues for success and to teach them a little bit more about discipline and finding out that you can be successful no matter who you are. And I'm kind of proud of this one fact. We redid the whole Kiri program by developing three different stages so kids could develop at a slower pace to the end. Because in the public league, you don't have the feeder programs that a lot of the suburban schools have. So we figured we had to, let's let them get step one, step two, step three, step four, and just kind of move them up the ladder and get them all into college and come back with degrees. And I always told my kids, the most important thing you could do if you wanted to reward me, show me your degree.
Yeah.
And I thought the coaching and teaching that part of it was real, real critical. And the kids would come back and say, Coach, I got my degree. Good.
Oh, that's great.
I'll put it up my ward. You know?
Yeah. Coach, can you hold on a second? We're going to take a break.
Sure.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Louis Acevedo and Mark DePue about this oral sports history project. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Talking about high school sports here on the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are the director of the Oral History Program at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, Mark DePue, and Coach Louis Acevedo. He's a former football coach at Clemente and Marie Curie High School in Chicago. Coach, I just wanted to give you a chance to finish that thought. You were talking about how important you thought being a coach was. For you, we've talked about how high school sports build character. For you, it was important for all to have all of your kids get their degrees. I just wanted to give you a chance to finish that thought.
Well, the only thing about that, you know, with coaching, I always tell my kids, too, that there are no small parts on this team in life, but the only small people that won't take parts. And that's kind of what a philosophy we had, because we always tell our kids, especially at the freshman meetings, there's 77 spots on this football team. Some of you have to find somewhere to play. If you didn't find it, you know, we're going to try to direct you some way or the other, you know. And that, to me, was rewarding when kids would say, I can play this, I can play that. I said, good. And that showed that they had drive and desire to move on to something else. And a lot of our kids did become successful.
Mark, one of the common themes that came up in the stories was Title IX, which expanded opportunities for girls' sports. That law went into effect in 1972. How were you able to capture those stories?
Well, again, Phil Pogue is the one who did all of these interviews, and he was very in tune with that and realizing the huge impact that had on high school sports. You know, before that time, the opportunities for women were very, very limited, and then there was just an explosion after that. And, you know, the young girls today, I don't think they have any idea that they're grandmothers, or maybe in many cases their mothers, didn't have the same opportunities to develop themselves and to develop their character. I want to mention also that I have another project here. It's on the sports stories page. It's called Girls Basketball, and that's because I had one of the people that I've interviewed, Ellen Barges, who played in the very first girls' state basketball tournament back in 1977. I interviewed her, but as part of her master's and PhD, she's interviewed something like 30 to 40 other women who were involved in those early days of basketball.
Wow, yeah. So it's interesting to hear all of this and to talk about the bonding that happened. And as you were saying, we had one more clip that we wanted to play. It's another bit of oral history that you all have collected. It features Coach Peg Kopick. She developed the girls' volleyball team at St. Francis in Wheaton, and a big goal for her was team bonding.
We had 60-some traditions. Some of them were silly. Some of them involved work, and some of them involved nothing. For example, something that cost nothing to do and took little time, I had all of my varsity girls put their own names on the varsity scoreboard. I didn't have a manager do that. I had each of them do that. Because if you put your own name on something, I think it means a little bit more. You're going to stand behind it a little bit better, I would hope.
That's Coach Peg Kopick, as we're talking about the role that Title IX played in the decades. Louis, I imagine things were a little bit different for you because you were sort of at the beginning of Title IX, right?
Right. I was in college in 72 when it was first enacted. But it really didn't affect us really until later on when we talked about funding and everything else.
Right. Mark, why was it important for you to kind of capture that as well?
Well, again, you know, a lot of people, they say sports, that's not really history. Well, I think it is. It's a huge part of history because it's part of who we are as a society, the emotions that we get involved with. But as Louis was talking about, it's the character development. It's the learning skills like perseverance. And for all these decades, the women didn't have that opportunity. And now after Title IX, those opportunities were presented to them, and they had the same chance to be proud about something, to be involved in a program, to learn about teamwork. And to me, that's a huge piece of history that deserves to be preserved.
All part of the project that the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library has done. Mark DePue is the director of its oral history program. I want to thank Coach Louis Acevedo for joining us as well, a former high school football coach. Gentlemen, thanks so much. We're going to tweet out all the links so everyone can listen to this if they want to, and it's a good moment for all of us to remember all of our high school sports days or those coaches who played important roles in our lives. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you.
As we like to do on Mondays, take a look at Illinois politics. It's been a bad year for retention in the Illinois General Assembly. As of today, we've lost 29 legislators, with Republican David Harris of Arlington Heights being the last to flee. There's another dropout that's making the headlines, Amaya Pawar pulling out of the race for governor, the 47th Ward Alderman in Chicago. First major tier hopeful to pull the plug, citing lack of funds and name recognition. On Monday, we talk state politics on the 21st. Joining me here in our Chicago studio is Mike Fouché, who's co-founder and publisher of Chicago's The Daily Line. Hey, Mike, welcome back to the 21st.
Great to be here. And not just Chicago, we also cover Springfield.
Yes.
We have a Springfield reporter now, too.
Right. So let's start with the legislature and Springfield.
Right.
29 resignations.
Zowie.
I mean, that's pretty unprecedented is a word we kind of, I feel
yeah,
like we
right.
use a lot when we talk about Illinois politics in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
What's going on?
I think that legislators absolutely totally despise being either dealing with Mike Madigan or dealing with Governor Rauner.
Because this is bipartisan, the amount of both Republicans and Democrats
it's
who are leaving.
It's pretty evenly split down the middle, Democrats and Republicans.
What do you think this says about the state of the legislature for Illinois? Do you think it's a good thing? I mean, on the one hand, we hear people like Governor Rauner saying that people have been in office too long and term limits has been something he's pushed. This is almost like an organic one. I don't know.
Yeah, Bruce Rauner has got his term limits wish. It's coming true. I mean, a lot of these people that are retiring are people who have been around for a long time. And a lot of these people that are retiring are people who have been considered moderates, people who work across the aisle and have a lot of good relationships and are well respected. We're not losing the bomb throwers here. We're losing people who are the workhorses of the legislature that get things done.
And when you talk to those individual folks, how many of them are saying they're just kind of fed up with what has happened over the past 2 years? Because we've sort of heard the varying degrees, right, of honesty about why people are leaving. I think some people have just said, you know, we saw Christine Redonio being very personal about the fact that she just wanted her life back.
Yeah. And she got out, like, she was out of Illinois, gone. Her husband had a job in Arizona. They had already gotten a house. They were gone.
Remind us again her role that she played as a Republican.
She was the state Senate Republican leader, and she was very, very well respected, very well liked. Both Democrats and Republicans liked her, and she, in many ways, was thought of as the bridge between Rauner's stridency and everybody else. And she got very, very close to putting together a grand bargain decision on the budget, you know, 6-9 months before there was finally a budget decision. And she was ultimately torpedoed by Governor Rauner. You know, I think that really the background to all this is, if you're a Democrat and you're in the House, or really in the House, if you're a Democrat in the House, you have to do all of your fundraising through Mike Madigan. You know, John Cullerton, the Speaker, or I'm sorry, not the Speaker, the President of the Senate, is a little less so. But if you're a Democrat in the House, you do all your fundraising through Mike Madigan. He pretty much controls all the purse strings. If you're a Republican, no matter who you are, the fundraising is done. And I've heard this tossed around by Republicans, by Uncle Bruce. You know, Uncle Bruce, the governor, and, you know, on the one hand, he's a nice uncle. On the other hand, he's a rough uncle. And he controls how the fundraising goes because he writes these huge, giant checks to the party.
Let's talk about the Democrats, right? So that's the Republican side. What about the Democrats who've left? I'm thinking of Elaine Nekritz. There's another senior sort of statesman in the legislature. But who else have we seen, say, on the Democratic side? They're not running either.
Well, there are a lot of Democrats that are bowing out because they're running for something else. Scott Drury was running for governor, and now he's running for attorney general. Kwame Raoul is now running for attorney general. So there are a lot of Democrats like that.
The younger ones, right?
I guess.
Because I'm thinking about Barbara Flynn Curry. Who had a very long career.
She's the majority leader. She's number two to Mike Madigan. But I think that in her case, it's probably more of an organic decision. You know, she's been around, I think, almost longer than, almost as long as maybe a term before Mike Madigan's when she started. So she's been around.
I feel like she should point out longer than our lifetimes,
right.
You and I.
I think 1972
okay.
is when she started.
Right. Holding office. Okay. So, I mean, all of that, what does that mean for as we sort of look to the landscape of next year and look at the legislature? You guys actually track this, right? You have a racing form for the Daily Line that looks at every legislative campaign.
We follow every legislative campaign in the state that we have a small subscription that you sign up for, and then you get a report every week. And we're actually calling every campaign in Illinois. We're talking to every single one, and we're following all their campaign fundraising and producing a 200-page report every week for anyone that subscribes. And what we're seeing, you know, already is that you see that not only are there all these resignations, but there are now a series of primary candidates that are being put up by more conservative, further right Republican groups. And it's interesting because you look at their websites, there's a template for the website for a lot of these primary
challengers. Do they all look the
same? Yeah, they do. You see a picture, there's a bio, and maybe a campaign contact at the bottom. They all have the same format. So there is definitely a concerted effort out there to put together more conservative candidates that will challenge existing Republicans.
Right. And, of course, that brings us to HB 40 and Governor Rauner's decision to sign that into law. That's the legislation that provides state health insurance and Medicaid coverage for abortions, protects the right for abortion should Roe versus Wade ever be overturned at the national level. Is that part of the anger towards Governor Rauner on the far right?
Yeah, most definitely. I think that that was probably the biggest catalyst. A lot of conservatives feel like they betrayed is the word that's used. Representative Peter Breen from DuPage County said straight up the day that Bruce Rauner announced his veto, that he was signing HB 40, he said straight up, this is a betrayal. And there's been a whole series of Republicans that have talked about running. You know, Representative Jeannie Ives from Kane County has talked about running, but I'm not sure that she's going to be able to put together the machinery and the money in order to run a real primary challenge.
Well, primary challenges for governors and money are the reason why Amaya Pawar pulled out from the governor's race. Young, I don't know if upstart is the word you want to use, but was an unexpected alderman a couple of years ago. He was sort of one of the, he's kind of, there's a huge tier of Democratic primary candidates for governor, right? He's the first big name to drop out. He said money and name recognition were his two big issues.
Yeah, definitely. And hey, you know, those are the building blocks of running for any office. You know, I've been covering Amaya Pawar since before he became alderman. I actually covered his aldermanic race in Chicago. And the way that he won was he started knocking doors before anybody else. And everybody in the neighborhood knew who he was as soon as the other candidates started to collapse.
A little harder to do that for governor.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that he was hoping to be able to catch fire with more of the Bernie Sanders kind of supporters, the left part of the Democratic Party. And he was hoping that they were going to get excited and give him money and give him volunteers. But there's been a lot of competition for those people. You know, Daniel Biss, State Senator Daniel Biss, who's also a Democratic candidate, has been competing for those people as well and has been pulling at that group. So I think that that's been a difficult challenge for him.
And that leaves sort of the big money players in the game, J.B. Pritzker, Chris Kennedy, sort of the ones who have been raising the most money at this point.
Actually, Daniel Biss
has raised more money.
I think he's the number two.
In terms of money raised.
Yeah. And Daniel Biss has been doing very well with raising money. You know, he has a great fundraising base. He comes from the North Shore. And so there's a lot of big check writers that are up there. You know, there's been an expectation all along that Chris Kennedy was going to be able to write a big check himself. You know, he used to own the Merchandise Mart, or that he would have some family members or somebody be able to secure the money that he needed. That hasn't happened. However, you know, one of the interesting things about Chris Kennedy is that he's has tremendous name ID with especially African-Americans in Chicago, and he remains to be very, very strong in that group of Democratic voters, which is a big problem for J.B. Pritzker.
So we'll see what happens. That's on the Democratic primary side for governor. It's amazing that we're talking about this, even though this race is not, you know, it's quite a ways away.
Yeah, but March 20th.
Yeah. I want to thank Mike Fouché for being with me. He's, as we said, the publisher of The Daily Line, which you can sign up for. Newsletters for Chicago.
DailyLine.net. Get the racing form.
Thanks for being with me, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we are out of time today. That does it for us here at the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from downtown Chicago, the Graduate School of Medill, Northwestern University. Thanks for tuning in. Head to 21stshow.org for past shows or more information on how to contact us, and have a good day.